It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
I have the best moveset.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want!
WWE uploaded the very first NXT live show that I ever went to its NXT Vault channel on YouTube this week. It was WrestleMania 31 weekend in San Jose, and it never aired on TV anywhere. So this is the first time it's been released. It is worth checking out. It's the first time that Kenta busted out a GTS since he had been rechristened as Hideo Itami, and the place went nuts for it. We got a Charlotte Flair against Sasha Banks match, one of their earliest matches against each other. Finn Balor against Adrian Neville. That's the era of NXT where I started watching. I do miss that time. I did a roundtable in San Jose the next day. That's Sound Off 375, if you ever want to listen to it. This, however, is Sound Off episode 907. 532 shows later, here we are for Sunday, March 30th. 2025, almost 10 years ago to the day that I did that show, in fact. And oh, do we have a lot to get to this week, including a major shakeup in TNA. CM Punk gets his WrestleMania main event, the first match inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. I'm going to talk about what that is. Thoughts on Tony Khan celebrating Dynamite passing Nitro soon. That's been a hot topic this week. Early predictions for Dynasty next Sunday. All the drama that spilled out into the open this week involving the Hogan family. Yes, we have another Hogan update. And yes, the Dark Side of the Ring reviews are back. And I've got a full review on the Hell in a Cell episode with Mick Foley. Mandy Rose is in the news. Just a ton of stuff to get to. If you would like to support the podcast, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal link at the top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. And I cannot go on until I shout-out all of these fine PayPal producers, including the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soap, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray. And just in a little while ago, a huge drop, a very generous drop from M. Mills, which I cannot say thank you enough. You may remember the name M. Mills from many of our YouTube streams. She is always supporting, and I just want to say thank you very much. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, the Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, Killshot, Keith Hart, with the double shot. Thank you, Keith. Tough guy, Temjin Zephyr. Hey, Temjin, my advice to you, just keep working hard. That's it, brother. Just keep working hard. Big homie, John Burton, two-time NWA East Brass Knuckles champion and former pre-show co-host for Impact Wrestling, showing some love for the Sound Off this week. And Rebel J. Leonard. Happy birthday, brother. I hope it was a great one. Whatever number it is, you are forever young. Two big announcements this week from House of Glory. First, we are expanding our wrestling academy to the Sunshine State. HOG Orlando is coming soon to the Orlando Oviedo area. And we'll also feature live events as we do here in New York. So stay tuned for more details on that. We've got HOG North, and now we're going to have HOG South. And from the Sunshine State to the Lone Star State, House of Glory is making its Texas debut the night before AEW All In, Friday, July 11th, at the Haltom Theater in Haltom City, Texas. It's just a 20-minute drive to Globe Life Field in Arlington, where All In is the next day. Tickets go on sale this Friday at hogwrestling.net. I'll start with the TNA news this week, because there was a big management shakeup on Tuesday. Per PW Insider, there were a number of exits from Anthem and TNA Wrestling on Tuesday. TNA President Carlos Silva issued a memo to Anthem staff announcing the departure of eight people. One of the most shocking departures was Ariel Schnerer, who was executive producer of TNA and effectively the head of creative. Schnerer had been with Anthem, TNA, and the Fight Network for many years. With his departure, Hunter Johnston, the former Delirious from Ring of Honor, will now head creative. which he did in Ring of Honor for many years. I know Jim Cornette has been complimentary of him whenever he's asked about Delirious. They worked together when Cornette was there. And it's rare that Cornette doesn't have a bad word to say about somebody, or at least it feels that way. All I'll say on Delirious is that I did not enjoy Ring of Honor during his run as booker nearly as much as I did when Gabe Sapolsky was booking. You know, Adam Pearce took over from Gabe after Gabe got fired, and then Pearce got fired not long after that. He had picked Delirious to be his assistant. So that's how Delirious ended up getting the job. When Pearce got fired, he slipped into the role. The same thing happened when they fired Cornette. It was supposed to be Cornette running things when they were kind of expanding, whatever year that would have been, 2011 maybe. And when he got canned, I forget, he was either fired or demoted to a lesser role, whatever it was. Guess who wound up as the head booker again? Delirious. The luck this guy has. Now here we are 15 years later, someone gets fired, and look who's waiting in the wings to take over as the head of creative. So he's got a mixed track record. Tommy Dreamer will remain on the creative team as well, but he'll also be heading up talent relations, because the other shocking departure was Gail Kim, former Knockouts champion, TNA Hall of Famer. She's been working behind the scenes in talent relations and as a producer. Gail's been with the company off and on for 20 years, all the way back to 2005. And she was one of the trailblazers of that Knockouts division. It was the matches that she had with Awesome Kong that helped put that division on the map. She's very well liked, very well respected among the people that worked there. Matt Hardy on his podcast said that he was shocked to learn about her firing. There may have been some very upset Knockouts venting their frustrations as well. Not even may have. I mean, they didn't mention her by name in their social media posts, but they've been posting angry emojis and whatnot. So clearly, a lot of very unhappy people about this news. They also vented their unhappiness after Scott D'Amore got fired, and in the end, nothing came from it. I doubt it's going to be any different this time. Rob Klingman, who was their chief revenue officer, is also gone, as is Michael Shuchenko, who worked in their digital department. He'll be departing TNA on April 30th, having worked there for 2 years. Karen Klevitt, who worked on their TNA Plus service, Romy Glazer, who worked in marketing, and Sebastian Dastrani, who worked on the live events end, will also be leaving the company. Raphael Morphy, who had been doing consulting work for them and trying to build the company's live event business, was also announced as moving on. Now, Morphy previously worked for both WWE and AEW, and he is said to have been involved in the company's great success of late, including the big houses that they had in El Paso. I knew of Morphy from when he worked for the New York Cosmos soccer team. He was their main point of contact with MCU Park when I was doing PR work for the Brooklyn Cyclones. The Cosmos played some games at the ballpark for, I think, that one season. I didn't deal with him too much outside of some emails that we exchanged, but you know, he seemed like a nice guy, clearly very competent at his job given all the places that he's worked. But unlike years ago when he actually worked there, this sounds like it was just the consulting role that he had. He'll simply just focus on the other work that he's doing. Although I don't know why you would want to lose somebody like that, especially when they seem to have been doing well on the live events end. But in a statement, Carlos Silva said, "Today we announced a restructuring resulting in staffing changes at TNA Wrestling. These decisions are always difficult, but it became apparent that we needed to make adjustments to our business strategies. We are grateful for those who have worked there or worked here and thank them for their years of dedication to the company. Finally, we want our fans to know that we are committed to producing the absolute best product and highest quality content that we can, and we appreciate their continued support." So in an update from Fightful Select, Sean Ross Sapp said on the subject of the Gail Kim firing, "It was a unanimously unpopular move based on those we spoke to, with at least one talent saying that it made the decision for them to not remain in the company when their deal was up. At least one person said they actually weren't surprised because Gail has been very outspoken creatively and would sometimes butt heads with people in control. Another person indicated that the same thing was the case, but also said that's what you want out of a person in her position, somebody who will advocate for a better show. We're told that Kim was very direct about her complaints when she felt like things could have been handled better or more professionally. She was not involved in creative and had been pushing heavily for the Knockouts division to do more after the departure of Scott D'Amore. One longtime name in TNA said they believe Anthem is going for a major regime shift with the departures of Scott D'Amore, Gail Kim, and Josh Matthews, names that had been around for ages. They pointed to the revolving door at TNA of presidents and the differing visions between them. Those that we spoke to claimed the decision was TNA president Carlos Silva's, and he told Gail that she was fired but did not provide a reason besides changes. Sources in AEW and WWE both said that they expected Kim to get interest across the wrestling world, and a few said that they were going to immediately push for such. We're told that she does plan to continue in wrestling. Kim has no non-compete and can appear for any wrestling company she wants or work wherever she wants to immediately. One alleged TNA insider named BQ, who has covered TNA online for years, claims that Gail butted heads with new TNA president Carlos Silva, but she also did not get along with Ariel Schnerer. They did not like each other, and the continued backstage turmoil led both of them to give Silva an ultimatum, and so he had to pick a side, one or the other. And instead of picking a side, he fired them both. Which, honestly, is not an unreasonable way to handle things. Like, if you have a dispute between two people and it's clear they cannot coexist, or you've got pros and cons with both of them, instead of showing favoritism towards one side or the other, getting rid of them both and eliminating the problem altogether, it's not LOL TNA. It's a business decision that I can kind of understand. Gail posted the following message on her Instagram. I just wanted to say thank you to the fans, friends, and especially my peers for all the support that you have given me over the last few days. I've received such an enormous amount of love, and it really has helped process this change for me. More than anything, I'm grateful for all the years and opportunities that I was given to help build something I always dreamed of. The Knockouts division is and will always be my heart and all the women who were a part of it. Thanks to the incredibly hardworking and passionate TNA talent and crew that I have had the pleasure of working with, this will not end my passion or my love for wrestling, and this is not the end of Gail Kim in the wrestling world. You don't put in 17 years in one company and stop when you are this passionate. I look forward to sharing my journey, and I'm taking some time for myself and prepare for what's ahead. Looking forward to the future. And one last thought, more women in leadership roles, not less. And she put a bunch of question marks at the end of it. You know, it goes without saying, she would be an asset to any promotion that scoops her up. WWE and AEW both should already be reaching out to her, and I don't think it's going to be very long before we hear about her signing a deal with somebody. The question, though, has come up to me about whether this is a sign that Anthem is preparing to sell TNA to WWE. Are these moves being made to cut costs ahead of selling the company? And there were a lot of signs with WWE years ago that they were looking to cut costs and tidy things up for a possible sale. I talked about that a lot on the podcast, and eventually the Endeavor deal happened. And it wasn't an immediate thing. I mean, there were moves that were being made when Vince McMahon first brought Nick Khan in, which would have been, 2020. And over a 2 or 3 year period, we would hear stories about, they're trying to kind of clean up the books and get some costs, off the books. And there were a lot of people who looked at that and said, this might be a sign that they're looking to sell. And then sure enough, eventually they did, but it wasn't like it was an overnight thing. In this case, I don't see this as any kind of sign that they're looking to sell to WWE, right? Not in the immediate future. I think we need to pump the brakes here. Why would WWE want to buy TNA right now? Why would they even want to? All right, let's think about that. Well, it only makes sense if the idea is not to continue running it as a separate entity, but to acquire the video library and acquire all of their international distribution deals, of which TNA has many. I can see those being of value to them. Obviously, the library would be of value to them. They could easily monetize that. We've already got the WWE vault and the WCW vault on YouTube. We're probably going to get an ECW vault at some point. And they could just throw up a TNA vault channel and they can rake in ad money from that and make money that way. Outside of that, I don't know why they would even bother. It was only a couple of months ago they issued a press release announcing a multi-year partnership with TNA. Selling the company is not an overnight thing. If they had any intention to buy the company, I don't think they would have announced a multi-year partnership with them. But why would they? Why buy it and run it as a separate entity? All right, that's why Tony Khan went and bought Ring of Honor. Had he not done that, WWE would have bought the bones of ROH. They would have picked off, you know, whatever they wanted as far as the trademarks and the video library. So many of their guys came through Ring of Honor. There's going to be a guy in the Night One WrestleMania main event who was in Ring of Honor and a world champion there. And then they would have taken it and put it on the shelf. They weren't going to run it as a separate entity. Or if anything, maybe we would have ROH on Tubi instead of Evolve. But that would be it, right? So Tony Khan's like, no, he loved Ring of Honor. He had a passion for Ring of Honor. He swept in and he bought the company and he's been trying to run it as a separate entity ever since. But there's no benefit in that to WWE doing that with TNA. They have NXT, they have Evolve, they have LFG, they have all of these things already. They don't need another division to add to their developmental system. They have a good thing going as it is, where they can send some of their less experienced talent to get more reps, and they can have a pipeline to new talent so that after they're done in TNA, they bring them into WWE. And none of this costs them a thing. It's like outsourcing a branch of their developmental to somebody else and letting them pay the talent. All without the costs and overhead that are involved in keeping TNA alive as its own brand. So no, I don't think they're preparing to sell to WWE. I can't rule it out and say it'll never happen, right? A year, 2 years, 3 years down the road, anything's possible. But no, I don't think these moves were made with a sale in mind. If Gail Kim was butting heads with their executive producer and it was easier in their mind to just get rid of both of them, then in their view, so be it. And for all the other people that are leaving, they are bringing in new people to replace most, if not all of them. You know, it sounds to me like typical corporate restructuring. But losing someone like Gail Kim is a big loss for them. And their loss is going to be somebody else's gain. Let's skip over to WWE. We got our second John Cena appearance on Raw this week in Glasgow. And his second appearance went mostly like the first one, where he heeled on the fans and he had nothing to say once Cody Rhodes came out. He did mention breaking the record and winning a 17th world championship this week and how he's going to ruin wrestling. He's going to win the title and make people forget the name Ric Flair. And he's going to retire with it as the last real champion in WWE. And he also brought up the spinner belt that he introduced many years ago and all the negative comments that it got at the time from all the wrestling fans who thought that it was a toy and he was disrespecting tradition with it. And how that was the worst thing that they could have done. Because now he knows how much the title means to them. He's going to win their precious title and leave with it. Right? That was the premise behind this entire promo here. At least he didn't promise to bring the spinner belt back. That was my fear. But Cody came out, and it was more of the same from the week before. With no response from John Cena, he said nothing. They teased the fight, but he ducked out of the ring. You know, him saying he's going to win the title and retire with it only makes me think that he's not winning the title at WrestleMania. But we've got one more appearance from Cena tomorrow night in London. Cody will be there. Will they give us the same segment 3 weeks in a row? I hope not. This is not resonating with me the way that I was hoping that it would. It's been pretty paint-by-numbers stuff so far. And right now, John Cena is not scheduled for any other shows after tomorrow until WrestleMania. And it would be ridiculous if we don't see him again, unless they really give us something big tomorrow night. But right now, you know, Cena is feuding. He's feuding more with the fans than he is Cody Rhodes. There needs to be more of a focus on him and Cody and why he did what he did to Cody at the Elimination Chamber. Forget the fact that The Rock hasn't been mentioned one time this entire, you know, series of segments. And he was the catalyst for all of this. But let's get things going here. Like, Cena's not wrestling the fans at WrestleMania. He's wrestling Cody Rhodes. That angle at Elimination Chamber was so good, it'll go down as one of the most shocking moments in the history of WWE. Since then, they have given us the bare minimum of what they could give us. And I don't want to hear, oh, you need to give it time. It's been one full month already. Dude, it's been a month. Tick tock. Time's a wasting. If Cena really wants to get heat, he should tell those fans in London tomorrow that he takes back what he said about London getting a WrestleMania. And he's going to use his influence with The Rock and TKO management to make sure that Saudi Arabia gets one before they do. They may carry him out of there in a body bag if he says that. Rhea Ripley is getting her rematch with Io Sky for the Women's World Championship tomorrow night. I don't know why she's owed a rematch before WrestleMania when it was made clear that whoever won their last match would be defending the title against Bianca Belair. But there isn't a whole lot about this angle that really has made sense, including Adam Pearce making Bianca the special referee for that title match, which even Bianca said, I've never been a referee. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to referee. To which Adam Pearce told her, well, you've got a week to learn. Now, why would he want someone so inexperienced to officiate, not only so inexperienced, but clearly someone who has issues with both women, more so Rhea Ripley, to officiate a title match with WrestleMania implications? But that's how we get to the triple threat match, because Bianca is not counting the fall for Rhea Ripley. Now on SmackDown, they held the contract signing for the triple threat match with Roman Reigns, CM Punk, and Seth Rollins. Punk was looking through the fine print for something, we didn't know what, and Roman Reigns told his wise men, let him know. And Paul Heyman told Punk, what you're looking for, it's in there. Which was that for the first time in his life, CM Punk will be closing the show at WrestleMania. He is finally getting his WrestleMania main event. And I said it last week, as soon as the match was announced, that's your night one main event right there. Three of the biggest stars in the entire company, in the entire industry, right? Including Punk and Roman against each other for the first time. And the history between all of these guys, this right here is your main event for night one. It's not Gunther and Jey Uso, and it's not the ladies. I'm sorry, but it's not. This is the right choice. Punk and Roman, they had, or Punk and Heyman rather, they had tears in their eyes as Heyman broke the news to him. Roman took credit for it. He wanted Punk to say thank you. Rollins was furious that Roman had a hand in giving Punk the one thing he was hoping to deny him, saying that Punk doesn't deserve it. You'll never see someone so angry to find out that he's in the WrestleMania main event, but that was Seth Rollins. He himself only just got his first proper main event last year in the tag team match. For Roman Reigns, this is going to be his 10th WrestleMania main event, including two of them last year alone. And the next closest is Hulk Hogan with 8. And they closed the show on Friday with the great cliffhanger line from Punk to Roman, said thank you, but that's not the favor that I'm owed. And it was so great the way they did this too, because first they had Heyman hit you with the news that Punk was getting the main event. So you assume, oh, that must be the favor. But then at the very end, they drop the bomb on you that, oh, that's not the favor. And then they immediately go off the air, leaving you wondering what the hell is the favor. I thought that was brilliant the way they did that. So what is the favor? Is it Punk requesting Heyman be his wise man for the match? I mean, that would be underwhelming after all the suspense if that's all it is. Is it the winner being added to the WWE title match on night two? Now, that wouldn't make much sense, because why would Heyman even have the stroke to make something like that happen, especially after what Punk said about The Rock after the Elimination Chamber? Making this a number one contenders match, though, with the winner getting a future championship match, that is absolutely something that they should do. And I floated this on the post show on Friday night. Let's say the winner does get added to the night two main event. Let's just say they do. And I know, yes, another triple threat match. But if they can find a way to explain that, I wouldn't even bother telling the fans what the favor is until after the main event on night one is over. Punk wins, and then he closes WrestleMania by announcing that the favor was the winner gets added to the main event of night two. And that's how they go off the air. That would be one hell of an ending. But I still say, you know, it's better to save the Punk match with Cena one-on-one for another PLE. Look, Roman and Punk would be a huge mega match that they can do. And I would imagine that we'll get it one-on-one at some point, but they're effectively already giving it away in the form of a triple threat. So I'm not in love with the idea that they would do the exact same thing 24 hours later with John Cena and CM Punk. That belongs on another show as its own standalone main event. And it has to happen before they turn John Cena back babyface, because everything that Punk said about him all those weeks ago means absolutely nothing. If John Cena reverts back to being a babyface before they do the match with him and Punk. So that match has to happen at some point in these next few months. But I would much rather it happen one-on-one than happen, you know, at the last minute as part of a triple threat. I'm just saying, if that ends up being what the favor is, I wouldn't even tell anybody. I would just have Punk win and then do the big reveal at the end of the show. But what that does confirm is that Jey Uso will not be closing the show, nor will Charlotte Flair. And I do think it's time we have a conversation about changing what the winner of the Royal Rumble gets. Because this is not the first time the person who wins the Royal Rumble does not actually close the show at WrestleMania, but this is the first time since they started having two Rumbles and they moved to the two-night format that neither winner is closing out night one or night two. And I think it's time that they amend things by stating that the winner of the Royal Rumble gets a guaranteed championship match at WrestleMania and leave out the main event part going forward. Like, that worked for many years. I know that was a big part of the attraction of winning the Royal Rumble. Things have changed. And you and I both know, if you are not closing the show at WrestleMania, you are not really the main event. They've had quote-unquote main events and Royal Rumble winners open the fucking show. On what planet is that a main event? All right, but they've gotten away with it for many years. You and I both know it's bullshit. And the way people look at it is, whatever match closes the show, that is the main event on that particular night. And I feel like we go through this every other year. You know, how come the winner of the Royal Rumble isn't headlining Mania? They said the winner goes to the main event. The main event isn't the opener. The main event isn't the night one main event. It's the night two main event, right? We go through this all the time. This can all be avoided by simply not saying that anymore. It's enough to say that the winner gets a world title match against the champion of their choosing at WrestleMania. That's a pretty big deal. And just leave it at that, full stop, because it is just not accurate to say it any other way. They could even use this on Raw tomorrow. Have Gunther be upset about how the World Heavyweight Championship is not being defended in the main event, and it's all Jey Uso's fault. Put this all on him, right? It just proves what I've been saying all along, that Jey isn't at my level, and now he's bringing me down to his, right? Now Jey has dragged Gunther down, and so he takes it out on Jimmy, which is how we end up with Gunther destroying Jimmy tomorrow because the two of them are having a match. I would lean into it. Use the main event stuff to play off of Gunther's anger, right? What should have been his first WrestleMania main event has been taken away from him thanks to Jey Uso. Now, the other news coming out of SmackDown is that matches are now being inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. They are billing them as immortal moments. And I don't know if that means it's going to be limited to only WrestleMania matches, since WrestleMania is the showcase of the immortals, or if all matches are eligible. But this is actually an idea that I was asked about once before on the podcast many years ago in the mailbag, and I thought it was silly. And I still think it's pretty silly, because now you're going to end up with people being inducted into the Hall of Fame 5 or 10 times, but I get why they're doing it. It's a good way to bring some of the big names back for the ceremony so they could sell tickets. Case in point, first match being inducted as part of the ceremony on April 18th is the submission match from WrestleMania 13 between Bret Hart and Stone Cold Steve Austin. And they announced both Bret and Stone Cold will be in attendance for the ceremony. And I know there's been talk of Ken Shamrock maybe being inducted this year. If he doesn't get inducted, they should have him do the induction for this, since he was the guest referee for that match. I mean, truly, you know, I was going to sit here and say, well, one of the greatest matches of all time, but fuck it, I'll say it. The greatest match in WWE history. When you take into account the quality of the match itself and the rivalry between those two coming into it, and you combine that with the historical significance of that match, the greatest double turn of all time, and the impact that it had on the career of Steve Austin, right? There is no Stone Cold Steve Austin without Bret Hart and without that match. The blood, the iconic shot of the blood dripping down Austin's face as he tries to fight out of the sharpshooter. Bret going back after him when the match was over. Shamrock with the waistlock takedown out of his boots. I mean, he got Bret Hart way up in the air. Austin then refusing help, gets to his feet all by himself. He leaves to cheers after entering to booze. People talk about Austin 316, right, in the speech at the King of the Ring. It was this match. This match is what set him on his way to what he would become. And what he would become is one of the biggest stars in the history of the business. And it's also a match that has incredible replay value. I can pick up with it anytime and never get bored with it. I mean, it's everything I love about pro wrestling. And I believe it is the greatest match in the history of that company. In maybe the most important year in the history of the company, because that was the turning point for them. People don't realize how close they came to bankruptcy. But they pulled out of it, and the creative had a lot to do with that. That year gave us this match. It gave us the first Hell in a Cell with Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. It gave us the debut of Kane. It gave us the Montreal Screwjob, which gave us the birth of Mr. McMahon. You know, it gave us the rise of The Rock. It gave us a lot of different things. It was such a huge year. So it's a well-deserved choice. And if Hogan wasn't such a fuck-up and a shitty person, I guarantee you Hogan against Andre at WrestleMania 3 would have been the first match inducted. And it would have been appropriate, too. The man who those first 7 or 8 WrestleManias were built around. The name most synonymous with WrestleMania. But he has so badly tarnished his legacy, they can't even celebrate him in the way that you know they would like to, because he's so toxic right now. Especially after that reaction on the Netflix premiere. There was no way any match with him in it was going to be the first one going in this year. Hogan versus Andre will go in one day. There's no denying how iconic that match is. As is Randy Savage against Ricky Steamboat. I just watched that match again the other day. It's so fucking good. The pace that they were working at. You just didn't see matches like that back then. Not in WWE, you didn't. The first Hell in a Cell. The ladder match from WrestleMania 10. Undertaker and Mankind Hell in a Cell. John Cena against CM Punk in Money in the Bank 2011. Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker from WrestleMania 25. I mean, we could be here all day. Yeah, they're going to have to induct 2 or 3 matches a year. Otherwise, you'll never get to all of them. But Bret Hart becomes the first ever 3-time WWE Hall of Famer with this induction. And I would say, you know, given how many classic matches he's had, he may become the first 10 or 15-time Hall of Famer when all is said and done. He'll have more rings than Brady does. He'll have more rings than he's got fingers on his hands. But I do wonder if this might replace the annual celebrity inductee, because they still haven't announced one yet. But there's still a few weeks left, so we'll know soon enough. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Did you know that traditional in-person therapy can cost anywhere from $100 to $250 per session? That can get real costly real fast. But with BetterHelp Online Therapy, you can save, on average, up to 50% per session. With BetterHelp, you pay a flat fee for weekly sessions, saving you big on cost and time. Therapy should feel accessible, not like a luxury or something that you have to pay a premium for. With online therapy, you get quality care at a price that makes sense and can help you with everything from anxiety to everyday stress. I say it all the time when I talk about this. If you pay for a gym membership to lift weights or do cardio, you need to look at taking care of your mind as something that's every bit as important. Your mental health is worth it. And now it's within reach. The benefits of therapy are legit, and they can be a game changer for you, whatever may be troubling you. Therapy can teach you things like positive coping skills and how to set boundaries in your life. And it isn't just for people that have experienced trauma in their lives. There's no problem, big or small, that you can't talk about. And oftentimes, just talking about it can start you down the right path to get the answers and solutions that you're looking for. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people all over the world. And it's convenient, too. That's what makes it even more appealing to so many people. You think those 5 million people don't have busy lives like you do? They find a way to make it work. And they don't have to try too hard either, because BetterHelp makes it easier for them with the click of a button. Even better, you can switch therapists at any time if you choose. It's good to have options. Your well-being is worth it. Visit BetterHelp.com/Solomonster today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Solomonster. AEW is celebrating a milestone episode of Dynamite on April 16th that they are calling Spring Breakthrough. And they are also doing a live collision that Thursday called Spring Breakthrough because they absolutely do not want to run head-to-head with WrestleMania. So they're doing a live Thursday show instead. But Dynamite that week will be their 289th episode. And that will surpass WCW Monday Nitro's 288 episodes as the longest-running weekly primetime wrestling show in the history of Turner Sports. WCW Saturday Night did not air in primetime. So even though it aired for longer, I guess it doesn't count. And the show will emanate from the MGM Music Hall at Fenway in Boston, Massachusetts. What a missed opportunity, you know, to do a spring break type episode like WCW used to do. I know Club La Vila isn't open anymore, but they totally should have done like an outdoor spring break episode somewhere. Of course, this kicked up a lot of angry tweets online from people who think this is just Tony Khan dunking on Eric Bischoff because Bischoff talks a lot of shit about him and his company and he shouldn't be talking because Dynamite can't hold a candle to Nitro, blah, blah, blah. Yes, Nitro, even at its worst, was still pulling numbers bigger than what Dynamite does today. And actually bigger than anything Dynamite has done in 5 years on the air. And yes, Nitro also went head-to-head with Monday Night Raw and pulled those numbers up against Raw, even beat Raw, for 83 straight weeks in the ratings. If you put Dynamite up against Raw or SmackDown right now, it would get slaughtered. It would fare about as well as TNA did when they tried the same thing in 2010, and that didn't last very long. Nitro changed the business. Dynamite did not change the business, but it did make the business better because it gave the fans a second promotion to follow on a major cable network, something that we didn't have since the TNA days on Spike TV. You know, Dynamite did not revolutionize the wrestling business, though, in the way that WCW Monday Nitro did. And I don't think anybody is saying that it did, not even Tony Khan. All Tony Khan is doing is promoting his show, and he is using this milestone as an excuse to do that. Which is why I don't see anything wrong with him doing so. Like, I just laugh at all the people who are upset about this or who are, you know, hurling comments and insults at Tony Khan for this. Like, I don't take it seriously because I see it for what it is. It is a promoter promoting his show. That's his job. And also, do you not think the fans online wouldn't be drawing attention to this anyway the closer we get? Like, you don't think the fans don't realize how close Dynamite is to passing Nitro's episode total? You don't think that they're not going to be talking about this, whether or not Turner and Tony Khan started promoting it? All he's doing is leaning into a conversation that the fans are going to be having online anyway. And it is an achievement that he should be proud of. You know, as I said on TNT the other night, Eric Bischoff does not like Tony Khan. Ever since Tony made that comment about Ted Turner not knowing 1% of what he knows about pro wrestling, and if he did, WCW would still be on the air. I think it's a stupid thing for him to have said. Ted Turner didn't run WCW, he owned it, but it's not as if he was booking the matches and making the day-to-day decisions. Right? The biggest decision he ever made was to give Eric an hour of live television every Monday night. People forget, even Eric forgets when he tells the story that they gave him 2 hours. Nitro didn't go 2 hours until the night Scott Hall debuted in 1996. Before that, it was an hour long. And that was the biggest decision that Ted Turner ever made, right? I mean, that and signing off on bringing Hulk Hogan into the company. Bischoff was offended by that comment, and he has had a hate boner for Tony ever since. So if this is Tony Khan's way of somehow sticking it to Eric Bischoff, I mean, I wouldn't even waste my time with him, but I say good. Have at it. All I see is a promoter promoting the fact that his show is about to reach a new milestone, and I don't see anything wrong with him doing so. I think people need to find something else to be fake angry about. Now, per Entertainment Weekly, Saraya is leaving AEW. She announced, I say per Entertainment Weekly, she has since announced it herself, but they broke the story. She announced that she is parting ways with the company in the first episode of her new Rule Breakers with Soraya podcast. And as she explains it, I'm here to tell you that me and AEW's relationship has come to an end. I had an amazing time there. There's no bad blood between us. I had such a magical time. And she explains that she wanted to take a couple of months off around the holidays for personal reasons. And then I got to thinking, what is there left for me to do in wrestling right now? Right now, there's really no storylines where I would fit in. And she also clarifies that her departure has nothing to do with Tony Khan. It's just me thinking that I don't fit in right now. I feel like I might be taking someone else's spot, someone who could be doing something really special. That's not to say that I will never come back to AEW. I absolutely love it. But I'm taking a little step back and focusing on myself for a bit and putting my energy into the podcast with all of the crew here. And she later tweeted, "It's mutual, but I loved my time at AEW and I had such a blast with the girls there. It'll hold a special place in my heart. Tony was a great, Tony was a great boss," I assume she means. "AEW was great. I feel so lucky to be a part of this family for a couple of years." Mike Johnson reports that her contract was set to expire in the fall. I'm surprised they never did the obvious program with her and Mercedes Moné, even if it was just like one last program before Soraya leaves. She just disappeared from television and we never saw her again. Yeah, she came back to wrestling with a lot of fanfare in 2022 after wrestling her last match in WWE in 2017. They would not medically clear her to wrestle after that. AEW did, and she won the Women's World Championship at Wembley in her home country. After that, she didn't do a whole hell of a lot, right? There were the Outcasts with her and Toni Storm and Ruby Soho. Based on the name that she has and as popular as she used to be there, I could see WWE wanting to bring her back, although there's no guarantee their doctors would clear her. You know, just because she was cleared and wrestled somewhere else doesn't mean that they're going to clear her. I mean, they probably would, but we don't know that. It's one of the reasons why she left and went to AEW. But I don't see her as someone that WWE needs to go out of their way to sign. You know, their women's division is just fine with or without Soraya. I really don't see her making a huge impact one way or the other. Right now, it sounds like she wants to step away from wrestling altogether. It doesn't sound like she's just leaving AEW to go right to WWE. But I'm sure she'll end up back there at some point. I mean, I can almost guarantee it. Whether she's wrestling or doing something else, you know, she will end up back in WWE at some point. Someone else who's in a contract year is former AEW Women's World Champion Mariah May. That is according to a report from Fightful Select. Per multiple staffers, wrestlers, and higher-ups, May's AEW contract is believed to expire later this summer. It is unknown if her current deal has any option years attached to it. However, one source within AEW said that they would be shocked if there weren't, as a deal as short as the one she signed is uncharacteristic considering the push that she received. She won last year's Owen Hart tournament, later defeating Toni Storm to capture the AEW Women's World title at All In London. Fightful notes that while May's contract is said to be up this summer, AEW is looking to retain her. Yeah, no shit. Word of May's pending contract status reportedly spread in AEW in recent weeks, specifically after she lost her title rematch against Toni Storm earlier this month at Revolution. Unlike Soraya, Mariah May is a must-have. Mariah May is someone that Tony Khan must re-sign at all costs because she is fantastic. And she's going to get paid, you know, no matter where she lands, but I think she stays right where she is. And if so, then she will be joined by an old friend of hers very soon, because it was also announced this week that Mina Shirakawa, the lovely Mina, is leaving Stardom, where she called home since 2020, and leaving Japan to move to the United States and work for All Elite Wrestling. And she has already been a part of the AEW roster on and off for some time now. At a press conference on Wednesday, Shirakawa confirmed reports that her contract with Stardom expires at the end of the month. However, she will continue to wrestle for the promotion throughout much of April, concluding with Stardom American Dream 2025 in Las Vegas on April 17th and April 18th. Shirakawa announced that she will join AEW after leaving Stardom. Last we saw her on AEW television was the December 11th Winter is Coming episode of Dynamite, where she lost to, funny enough, Mariah May in her bid to become the AEW Women's World Champion. Mina is great, Mariah is great, and they should both be a part of that women's division for many years to come. We are 7 days out from AEW Dynasty in Philadelphia, and the card has mostly taken shape, so let's run through the confirmed and not yet confirmed matches and give some early predictions, knowing that we will obviously still have a Dynamite and a Collision to go before the pay-per-view next weekend. The Hurt Syndicate are very likely defending the AEW Tag Team titles against Big Bill and Brian Keith, although that is not yet official. Chris Jericho is growing very impatient with his men and wants them to win matches. And MVP told them on Wednesday that if they can actually win a match first, they might even get a shot at the tag team titles. So last night on Collision, they beat Top Flight. Originally, it was going to be the Hurt Syndicate against the Murder Machines, but Brian Cage suffered a knee injury at an indie show, so they pivoted to the Learning Tree. I imagine that, you know, this match gets made on Wednesday, and Lashley and Benjamin will retain. It looks like this Learning Tree stuff is finally winding down soon. Speaking of the Learning Tree, also not official yet, but Chris Jericho on Wednesday issued the challenge to a title versus mask match for the Ring of Honor World Championship against Bandido at Dynasty. And, you know, they have a Ring of Honor pay-per-view coming up on May 2nd, Supercard of Honor. But Bandido's not losing his mask. So I say Bandido wins the title here, and then we probably get one more match between them at Supercard of Honor. And when Jericho loses there, no thanks to Big Bill and Brian Keith, that may be where the implosion happens. Daniel Garcia defends the TNT Championship against Adam Cole. They have already had two matches so far this month. The first one went to a no contest. Their last one went to a time limit draw. So this time it'll be no time limit and no interference allowed. And I just love how these companies, they have the power to make a no interference stipulation for a match. It's like, well, then why wouldn't they make every match no interference? Just one of those little wrestling inconsistencies. But I'm going with Adam Cole here to win the title. Daniel Garcia is, he's a fine wrestler, but that's it. The company is filled with great wrestlers. There's absolutely nothing about him that stands out. I think they gave him the title because he re-signed, and that's it. And I think the TNT title has really been dragged down the last several months. Garcia is also the kind of babyface who is better off chasing than he is defending. So it's time. It's time to get that title onto somebody else. The Death Riders defend the AEW Trios titles against Adam Copeland and FTR. There is trouble in paradise with Rated FTR. I like the sit-down interview they did with Tony Schiavone on Wednesday. Dax Harwood has been acting very heelish. He's very up in his feelings. Cash Wheeler has not been. He's been trying to keep his friends together on the same page so they can win the titles. Harwood lost to Wheeler Yuta on Collision last night, clean no less, and he didn't take it very well. He put his hands on referee Paul Turner after the match. Security had to come out. Wheeler came out, the other Wheeler, his Wheeler, Dax Wheeler. Dax Wheeler. Cash Wheeler. Good Lord. Yes, Dax Wheeler came out to confront Cash Harwood. But anyway, Harwood thought it was a member of security that was trying to pull him away, so Harwood shoved him down. Only then, when he turned around, did he realize his mistake, and he tried to help his partner up, but Wheeler wasn't having any of it. I'm not buying any of this at all. I think FTR are turning together on Copeland. The only question is, does it happen during the match next Sunday, or does it happen after they lose? Is it going to be a legitimate attempt to win the Trios titles? They fail, and they snap and take it out on Copeland, or is this some kind of big elaborate swerve, which really wouldn't make a whole lot of sense if they wrestled a fucking 15-minute match only to then turn on Copeland. You know, like when the Horseman turned on Sting. But I'm going to say it happens after they lose, and the Death Riders retain, FTR goes heel, and this is how we eventually get to a Copeland-Christian reunion against FTR in Texas at All In. I think that's the destination. Kenny Omega defends the AEW International title against Ricochet and Speedball Mike Bailey. This is going to be a great match. I think everybody pretty much figures that, and also figures that Kenny Omega is not losing the International Championship. All roads lead to champion versus champion, title for title, probably a unification match, which is exactly what it should be, in Texas between Omega and Okada, who isn't even on this show. So it'll be a great match. The only question is, it's not so much who wins, it's who takes the pin. And in this case, I'm going to say it's Ricochet. And that's their way of protecting Mike Bailey by not having him take his first direct loss. But Kenny Omega is retaining this title. 100%. Timeless Toni Storm defends the AEW Women's World Championship against the undefeated Megasus, Megan Bain, who has the champion's number. She pinned Toni in the tag team main event on Wednesday with her finish. Then on Collision last night, she dropped Toni on the championship belt with her finish, her F5. Toni opened the show last night with a promo, and they had this great tight shot where she was right by the ropes, and she was talking into the camera, spotlight was on her. And because the camera shot was so tight, we didn't see Penelope Ford coming. She was on the apron, and she came. All you see is a boot come into camera view, and she boots her right in the face. That was a fantastic shot, the way they did that. But this has been all Megan Bain so far. You know, and again, we have two shows left, so maybe Toni will stand tall in the end, but it's hard for me to imagine Toni Storm being dominated like this week after week and then losing the title. Maybe we don't get a decisive finish, right? So they could run this back again. But I'm going to go with Toni Storm to retain. I'm not prepared to say that it's going to be just a straight up clean win, but I do think Toni retains. You know, if they really wanted to create a new face for this division, then they would go all the way and they would put the title on Bayne and keep her undefeated. But I think Toni goes into All In with the championship. They have done a commendable job, though, of protecting Bayne and making her out to be a legitimate threat to the title. And Jon Moxley defends the AEW World Championship against Swerve Strickland, 1 year to the very event where he won his first AEW World title. I am not 100% convinced that they are changing the title. I want to believe that they are going to do the right thing, though. And the right thing is to get that fucking belt off of Moxley. So I am, with some hesitation here, I am picking Swerve Strickland for the win. I think Swerve becomes a two-time AEW World Champion. There are any number of people that he could defend that title against in Texas, including Hangman Page, Will Ospreay, MJF, all names, by the way, who are not scheduled for a match right now at Dynasty. There's no Ospreay, there's no Hangman, there's no MJF, there's no Okada, there's no Takeshita, not even Mercedes. Although that may change this week. Because last night on Collision, it finally happened. It finally happened. The Ring of Honor Forever Champion, Athena, made her return to TV. And not Ring of Honor TV behind a paywall. I mean actual cable television with actual viewers. After insulting the person who trained Billy Starks as somebody who knows nothing about pro wrestling, you knew that this was setting up an Athena debut, return, whatever you want to call it, to TV. She confronted Mercedes. The two of them got physical. Mercedes was able to avoid an O-face. And later on in the back last night, Athena announced that she too was entering the Owen Hart Foundation tournament, which Mercedes had already announced that she was entering. And in fact, we had six names announced for the women's bracket last night. Mercedes, Athena, Billy Starks, Jamie Hayter, Chris Statlander, and Thunder Rosa, which would leave two spots open. And you could easily fill those two spots just by plugging in two former winners of the Owen, Mariah May and Willow Nightingale. Or if you want, you can get Harley Cameron in there. You know, they also have Penelope Ford and they have Julia Hart. So, I mean, it's not like they don't have people, but this lineup is already stacked just with Mercedes, Athena, Hayter, and Statlander alone. And on the men's side, Will Ospreay, Hangman Page, Jay White, they've all entered themselves. I think MJF has to be in there. So I love how Tony Khan is actually loading these tournaments up in a way that he hasn't before. The full brackets will be announced this Wednesday on Dynamite. We still have not been told when the tournaments are going to actually begin or when and where the finals are taking place. The last 2 years, they've held the finals in Calgary at the Saddle Dome, but there are no Calgary dates on the calendar. Now, assuming the Owen is kicking off right after Dynasty, I would have Mercedes and Athena face off either in the opening round or in the semifinal round and have them go to a time limit draw. So that way, neither woman takes a loss. And that's their first match. And then you build to an Athena title win at All in July. Now, how you go about doing it really depends on timing, right? They've got a Ring of Honor pay-per-view on May 2nd. The biggest match that they could headline that show with would be Athena defending the Ring of Honor Women's World title or do title versus title against Mercedes. Now, do they want to do that on a Ring of Honor pay-per-view or do they want to save that for Double or Nothing? Both shows are in the month of May, right? The Ring of Honor show is at the very beginning of the month. The AEW show is towards the end of the month. Either way, I see this as a three-match series. They draw in the first, Mercedes wins the second, and Athena beats Mercedes to win it all in Texas. She's a Texas girl. It would just feel right to do it there. And I know there are a lot of people saying Mercedes Hogan, she's going to beat Athena, collect another belt, and then move on to Toni Storm. They have convinced themselves that this is the way it's going to work. Mercedes is not moving on to Toni Storm before dropping the TBS title. And she is going to drop the TBS title to Athena. And I know there are people saying, nope, she's not going to drop it until she breaks Jade Cargill's record. Jade Cargill's been the TBS champion for 508 days. Well, Mercedes is only around like 308. So for her to break Jade's record and become the longest reigning TBS champion of all time, that would take her through what, October? Can't keep the TBS title on her until October. The story is right there. They got this big stadium show coming up. The stage is set. I think people are freaking out for no reason. That's how I see it playing out. And in the end, Athena will be the TBS champion. Now, in this week's Hulk Hogan update, this one focuses more on drama involving the Hogan women. But before we get to that, let's talk about the Hulkster first. This is the more lighthearted part of this segment. You may have heard that boxing legend George Foreman recently passed away, and while he doesn't really have any tie-ins to the pro wrestling world, which is surprising given all the other boxers who have gotten involved in wrestling over the years, I don't know why he never did, but he is part of a famous tall tale told by Hulk Hogan about what ended up becoming the George Foreman grill. This is a story that I've told on the Sound Off before. It's one of the legendary Hogan fables. As a little boy, I enjoyed Aesop's fables. As an adult, I love me a good Hogan fable. And on this one, he has had different versions over the years. There was the one that he told on Hogan Knows Best, where he said that his kids were always upset that he would pick them up late from school. So one day he got there early, and then when he got home, and even that, he's told different versions where he got there early and he had all kinds of candy and treats for them waiting in the car. But then in other versions of the story, he went to McDonald's and he got hamburgers and French fries. I don't know what he's feeding these fucking kids. But even that, there have been different versions of it. But, you know, he got there early. And then when he got home, he had a voicemail waiting for him from one of his lawyers telling him that he had a grill and a blender that he could promote. And he was calling Hulk first to see if he wanted the grill before going to George Foreman with it. And when he called the lawyer back, he said George had already taken the grill. And $450 million later, the rest is history. So later, he told another version of the story where he was having a chat with his agent who was telling Hulk that he should put his name on one of these kitchen appliances. And he had this meatball maker. And Hulk loved the idea of the meatball maker. And when the agent asked him, well, what about this other thing? Hulk told him, go ahead and give it to your other client. And of course, this never happened. The real story is that Henry Holmes was Foreman's lawyer, and he also happened to be Hogan's lawyer for many years. And Henry Holmes has said that it was it was Foreman that the grill maker, who made the product, always wanted for the deal. But you hear Hulk Hogan tell it, he was their first choice. But that was never the case. He was never their first choice. He was never a choice. But that grill sat in Foreman's house until he finally decided to try it one day, and his wife told him, oh, I already did, and it actually works. So why do I bring all this up? This week, Pablo Torre, who used to work for ESPN, on his Pablo Torre Finds Out podcast, talked about the Foreman grill story, you know, in light of his passing. And he actually got a statement from the family of the Foreman grill maker, Michael Bohm. And in the statement, the family said, George Foreman was the only celebrity our dad approached about endorsing the grill. We don't know who started the story about Hulk Hogan being approached, but, oh, I know exactly who started that story. He's got an abnormally orange complexion. But they say, we don't know who started the story about Hulk Hogan being approached, but it isn't accurate. Now, they also went to Henry Holmes, who said that his recollection of events is different than Hogan's, and that the agent involved at the time, this guy named Sam, had two other celebrities in mind for possible merchandising deals, and then possibly for the grill, one being Pamela Anderson, and the other being Chuck Norris. But ultimately, it was George Foreman who got the grill. So in none of these versions of the story is Hulk Hogan even mentioned, other than in his own mind. But we also had a lot of drama this week involving the female members of the Hogan family. And honestly, when this was just the one video from Linda, I was like, I'm not even going to mention this. But now there's been so much back and forth, it's just blown up into this big story. And it began with what really was a cry for help on Instagram from Linda Bollea, Hulk's ex-wife. This made headlines on TMZ. This woman is an absolute mess in this video. She looks like the fucking Lady Elaine puppet from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. She's crying and moaning about the fact that her daughter hasn't spoken to her in almost 8 years before calling her ex-husband a liar and a sex addict. I can think of another word to describe her ex-husband, but she didn't use it. But before I get into her daughter's response to all this, and there has since been a bitter back and forth between them, this is from the video that sparked the entire thing from Linda Hogan. I am home by myself today, again, as usual. I'm okay with most things, but today something hit. I don't know what, but I look terrible because I've been crying, and yesterday I went to try to go have Botox and shit, and they bruised me, like, I don't know, but it's been 15 years since I left Hulk Hogan, and my family is in the worst mess. Brooke doesn't talk to us. She's had twins. She got married. She didn't tell us she had twins. She didn't tell us. She had a huge fight with Terry. I don't know how that reflected onto me, but she cut me out too. I haven't talked to her for 7 years, almost 8 years now. God bless Nick. He's still such a good boy. Yes, yes, he's such a wonderful boy. Maybe she can get engaged to another one of his friends. You know, after she and Hulk got divorced, she got engaged to her son's 21-year-old friend. He was 21, she was 50. They started dating when he was 19. They ended up calling the wedding off. Shocker. Had they gotten married, that would have made him Brooke's stepfather. And Brooke was a year older than him. No wonder she wants nothing to do with this fucking family anymore. But she wasn't finished. I've never put a Facebook post out like this with my ugly face and my crying face, but I have to be honest about what I went through in my marriage with Terry as Hulk Hogan and what it entailed and what it has caused over the years. He's a complete liar. He is a sex addict. Yet he marches on. Oh, I'm promoting my own beer. Real American beer. Oh, she made sure to get the plug in. Real American beer. Yeah, look at me. Woo! Yeah, he's such a hero. Not. And then she gives him a thumbs down in the video. I've given him more opportunities to come back and make us a family. It's been 20 years and I'm still this sad. Somebody, please explain that. I don't know. It just doesn't get better. I do love living alone. I don't ever want to be married again after him. Trust me. So that was Linda Hogan. So then Brooke, who is no longer going by the Hogan name, but well, not she wouldn't go by Hogan, but, you know, the Bollea name. But her married name of Brooke Oleksii. She's married, if you don't know, she's married to Stephen Oleksii, who used to play in the NHL for the Capitals and the Penguins. She has dropped off the face of the earth in recent years because she had twins and didn't want to be in the spotlight anymore. Plus, she wanted to get away from her family. She took to her Instagram to address her mother's rant. And this is very long, but I think it's worth reading the entire thing. I try very hard to ignore issues surrounding my family in hopes that I might have peace in my life. Sadly, I've intentionally made myself smaller in my professional career in music and TV, simply to dodge the public negativity surrounding my family that has continuously and relentlessly overshadowed anything I do. If it were just me, I would continue to take the hits and shrink even smaller to avoid the dangers of speaking publicly. But I have my own family now, and it's affecting more than just me at this point. There was a recent video posted by my mother that was concerning enough for people to send to me that has made me feel the need to address the tip of a very large iceberg that is my immediate family. What little I am addressing does not even scratch the surface of what I've dealt with my entire life. I will start by saying this video is mild compared to behavior that I have witnessed for the greater portion of my life. This also comes in addition to false claims that she's previously posted, then deleted. That being said, she has been through a lot of trauma and pain. My heart breaks for her. You can't control how others treat you, but you can control how you treat others and cope with things. Too many times I have ignored things said about me and haven't spoken my truths. Even so, I will keep things as vague as possible to continue to protect people that should have protected me. Most importantly, I have completely separate reasons for going no contact with each of my parents. No contact with my mom has nothing to do with my dad, and no contact with my father has nothing to do with my mother. This also pertains to my dad's second and third, now, current wife. This decision was made based purely on how they have each dealt with me directly my entire life. What I am about to say is not pointed at either person and is in no particular order when it comes to who did what. It is my own personal truth, and you can do your own math. I have been extremely verbally and mentally abused since childhood. Sadly, it would frequently turn physical. And sometimes it's not by the person that you would assume. Abuse comes in all shapes and sizes. This vicious pattern has robbed me of any sense of self-esteem and confidence that I have been trained to pretend to have. It took me many years to figure out the things that were seemingly done, quote, for me, really benefited someone else in a greater capacity. Up until adulthood, I've received berating and vile text messages, verbal public reamings with unbelievably hurtful words said to me that cannot be forgotten. I've been asked to defend poor behavior to the public and have done so out of love, only to find that I was misinformed, manipulated, and lied to. Still to this day, I have faced constant ridicule for those poor decisions of others. I've watched others benefit financially off of my suffering and embarrassment caused by their selfish behavior. While it caused my life to crumble, I continued to stay strong and silent. I was expected to, and did forgive massive blows to my career and personal life, nasty behavior, omissions of truth, blatant lies, manipulation, and repetitive errors in hopes of renewing previous family bonds. I have been used as a pawn, a buffer, and been treated like I'm downright stupid. No child or human should ever experience something like this. Feeling injustice, not speaking my truth, dealing with smear campaigns, flying monkeys, enablers of this behavior, watching fake win over what's real, and losing other family members and friends in an attempt to stop gossip and ongoing drama is also a painful side effect of this decision that I deal with daily. Many people witnessed this behavior and never took action or took a stand for me. But I did watch them stick around for the freebies, the money, and association to fame, all of which I chose to give up and was never important to me in the first place. I guess some don't speak to avoid getting caught in the crosshairs as well. I can't blame them. My family is very skilled at war. I so badly wanted to see good in them, protect, help, and start anew, just to be disrespected again and again. I longed for a normal family, but it never came. I've repeatedly held my hand out to help them, only to have them pull me into the darkness with them. I've set boundaries that were not respected, and at this point, I can truly do no more. So here I am, as an adult, with a loving husband and two beautiful children of my own. And what I can do is take control. I have been to therapy. I am doing the work. I am breaking the chain. It ends with me. Each individual on their own has given me more than enough reasons over the years to make this extremely hard and painful decision to end contact. As much as I not only understand and have empathy for their own struggles, I absolutely love them with every fiber of my being, which deep down I think they know. My heart hurts every day, and not a day passes it does not affect me. Inside of me, there is a little girl who desperately wants and needs her mom and dad. No one wants this, to feel so much pain and not have parents, but their behavior became more painful than their absence. I hope one day they realize, appreciate, and respect why I have chosen to remain as quiet as possible, not exposing specific names and details of certain experiences to still try to protect them. It is not something easy to handle, feeling like you're on an island. Many don't know that years ago I waited tables to build my own business with zero financial help from others, but I have worked hard my whole life. Cycles must be broken. I feel God has given me the strength and duty to do so. At this point, my husband, my children, and my relationship with God is my priority. There have been more than enough chances and reprieves given. It has to stop. It ends now. I will not let the false narrative continue past this point. Please heed my warning. I am choosing peace, but do not mistake my kindness or silence for weakness. There are families without food, parents with sick children, real hardships going on in the world, and our family was more than blessed, and everyone chose to play their cards differently. Accountability is a game changer. Life is so precious. I want so much to be able to enjoy what's important. My children and my life, I've worked so hard to create and protect, and I hope that everyone can give me the chance to do that without injecting any more poison into it. And, you know, as someone who lost both of his parents, you know, part of me looks at this and wants to say, you know, mend those broken fences, right? You never know what you have until it's gone. Your parents aren't going to be around forever. But just because they're your parents, just because you're bound by blood, does not mean that you are obligated to them for the rest of your life, especially if you feel like they're making your life worse and not better. And if they're not acting like parents, if they're acting like a spoiled brat. What she's alleging here is abuse, which is very serious. I have a lot of respect for her cutting out the toxicity for the sake of her own family and, you know, dropping out of the spotlight and doing her own thing. Now, it wasn't 24 hours later, after Brooke released that statement, that Linda responded on her Facebook page. And so what did she do? This woman who bemoans the fact that her daughter, her only daughter, will not speak to her for 8 years and that she doesn't even get to see her grandchildren, right? So what is her solution to all that? It is to attack her. This is what she said. Seems narcissism runs deep in this family. Brooke is a narcissist, just like her dad, going out and spewing lies to everyone, and I'm supposed to defend my truth against that. I'm not about to do that. It seems to me that she doesn't want the truth being revealed to her new husband and his family about who she was and things in her past. I think I spanked Brooke once. Yeah, I called her a couple of names, but by no means ever treated her the way that she's painting it. They had cell phones. She could have posted horrible things about me back when all of this was supposedly happening, but she didn't because nothing was happening. But when she took her dad's side after the divorce and wrote the wonderful Mom song and went to all the tabloids because Terry was using her as a tool, her memory is completely skewed about the treatment that she received growing up in our household. And you can talk to anyone. You can ask anybody. You can ask Terry. None of that stuff ever happened. It's her angle to keep her family away from her now. Revealing who she used to be after drinking a half bottle of vodka. She was so drunk she broke my collarbone and cut my lip and insisted everyone take her to the hospital because she was poisoned, and she wasn't. She was just drunk. There's many stories like that. I'm not going to go on, but I'm going to defend myself against these ridiculous allegations, or not defend myself, she says, and said, I'll do that in court if she keeps it up. And as I read this, it reminded me so much of Vicky Guerrero's response to her daughter 2 years ago when her daughter accused her stepfather of sexually assaulting her on the Jericho cruise in 2020. I was on that cruise, which is creepy to even think about. She said that she wasn't the only one either, but that was their story to tell. Chavo chimed in at the time on social media and said that he had been helping Sherilyn privately ever since, basically throwing his full support behind the daughter. And so Vicky's horrendous response to all of this at the time was to attack her daughter as a narcissist and as a drunken whore, in so many words, is basically what she called her, and threatening to take her to court. Sound familiar? I had to do a double take to make sure I wasn't reading Vicky's old post. And nowhere in Vicky's post, by the way, did she ever deny her daughter's claims, which was very interesting. All things considered, I actually thought Brooke did a good job, though, of keeping it civil and holding back on her mom. It sounds like she could have said far worse about her, but she opted not to. But Linda decided to go scorched earth, and she decided to go into attack mode. This is a woman who is completely oblivious to the fact that she may be part of the problem here. Evidently, she doesn't think so. And so Brooke responded again, saying, first of all, it appears my mother may not have actually read what I wrote. She absolutely did make false claims, like she had never met my husband and she doesn't even know what his name is, and then deleted it. She went on to claim that despite her mom saying that she hasn't spoken to me for a number of years, she has a picture with her and my husband together on a day that we did lunch together. I did not ask for this, nor did I even want to make a statement, but I also couldn't let people continue to speak for me. My name is continuously brought up in the constant drama of my family. My post did not directly accuse anyone of the behaviors mentioned. So if she's triggered by something, I think that speaks volumes. She is, however, making a serious accusation against me directly that has zero validity, and that I take seriously. I have plenty of people who know the truth, and I know the truth, so I am not afraid. I showed compassion for her in my post. At this point, I think her response says more about her than it does about me. So Brooke's husband responded to all of this next. I mean, this is just this cascading drama here, which is one thing after another. So he responded on Instagram that he could take no more of seeing his wife's name dragged through the mud. And this is what he wrote. I cannot stand by and allow anyone to continue to hurt not only the most amazing person I am fortunate enough to call my wife, but also the distorted sense of power and relevance the media can sometimes grant individuals. The claim that my wife broke Jane Doe's collarbone, he doesn't want to name her, was laughable to those who know the truth. I myself have only had one sip of alcohol in my life, and that was to celebrate a Stanley Cup championship victory at the age of 32. My wife will have the occasional cocktail or glass of wine, but neither of us have ever used drugs or any other substance that may alter reality. So it should be understood that the suggestion that my wife is a party girl or a drunk comes shortly after the assertion that I had never met Jane Doe and that she didn't know my name, despite the fact that we sat at the same lunch table and even took a picture together. And he also dismissed claims that the couple tied the knot without the knowledge of the family, called it unfair because they were reportedly left with no option when another party involved said they don't do weddings or funerals. And while he doesn't name the other party, it is implied that that person is Hulk Hogan. It says, unfortunately, it was the only viable option when another party involved said, I don't do weddings or funerals anymore, which is perplexing considering that same person has attended multiple weddings since then and even a wedding of their own. He went on to share instances highlighting who Brooke is at her core for those who may still have doubts about his wife's character. In one example, he says, this individual, presumably Hulk, refused to attend a Stevie Nicks concert with Brooke, making a false claim that they do not attend concerts anymore, even though they have since been spotted at concerts, sporting events, and comedy shows. In another example, he claims that Brooke renovated and designed a home for the individual, again presumed to be her dad, for free, hoping to only watch a sunset together, which this person refused to do by walking away, so she watched it by herself. My wife made a final resolute decision. She asked to be removed from all future financial involvement, requesting her release from documents that had her in a substantial fiduciary and financial position once certain events transpired. She said to me, if I can't have honesty and time with them, I don't want anything. And it goes on from there. It's a much longer statement, but he's standing up for his wife. And even as I am sitting here recording this, I noticed before, there has been even more that has come out. The one thing is apparently Hulk and his wife posted on his Instagram a video that he very quickly deleted because I don't think it's there anymore. But of course, you could always find it on social media. It will live on forever. But it was meant to be a funny video. It's him. It's Hulk and his wife sitting in a restaurant somewhere with two giant bags of popcorn. And they're looking at something, and they're obviously it's a reference to all the ongoing family drama. They're making light of it, which is a wonderful reaction to all of the things that your own daughter had to say. But I think that's enough for today. It sounds like she simply had enough of her parents' shit and decided to cut all ties, even financial ones, that she might benefit from, just to leave that part of her life behind and try to have some semblance of normalcy. And I say good for her. She always seemed like the most sane out of that entire bunch. But it's sad that she's raising a family and cut her parents out. But if I had parents like that, I wouldn't want them around my kids either. There are iconic matches in wrestling that will live forever, right? Matches that are going to be talked about and dissected. And one of the most famous of them all is the Hell in a Cell match between Mankind and The Undertaker at the King of the Ring in 1998. I can remember exactly where I was when I watched that show. I was in my living room watching with my brother and my father. I was sitting on the floor right in front of the TV. My dad was sitting on the recliner behind me. And when Mick Foley got thrown off the top of that cell, my father wasn't one to sell like shock or fear or anything like that if he was watching wrestling. Yeah, he may laugh at something, but on this night, he was shocked. I was shocked, right? Everybody was shocked by what they saw when you see this 300-pound man flying through the air from 16 feet up, and there's no net. There's no one there to catch him, although who the hell is going to catch him from 16 feet up? I'm getting my ass out of the way if that's the case. But it's still one of the craziest things that I've ever seen. And little did I know that it would get even crazier as the match progressed. The word I would use to describe this match is it was an experience. And it was sort of a dividing line in the career of Mick Foley because there's pre-sell and there's post-sell. Yeah, that man took a lot of bumps and a lot of punishment in his career long before he ever scaled that cage. But the abuse that he took that night in Pittsburgh is something that likely took years off his life. Forget his career, his life. And I do worry about the long-term effects and what Mick Foley is going to sound like and be like 10 years from now. And that's just me. As a fan, what must his family think? How concerned must they be? And that was one aspect to this episode of Dark Side of the Ring, the first one of the new season, season 6, that makes this something other than just a rehash of a match that we've heard about already 6,000 times. It's the human toll on the man and his family. Mick Foley is not a crash test dummy. Mick Foley is a human being who is lucky that he made it out of there alive that night, despite his own stupidity and the stupidity of the company that allowed him to do it in the first place. And even after that first bump, they allowed the match to go on. All in the name of creating a lasting moment on a television show where grown men and women play fight with each other. Like, I'm a wrestling fan. I've been a wrestling fan my whole life, but even I can sit here and admit how fucking dumb it all really was. Right? It was memorable, for sure, but at what cost? Not only to Mick Foley, but to all the other wrestlers and people that, you know, kids that got into the business thinking that they had to do the same thing to get over. Or they had to somehow find a way to top what Foley did that night. That is part of his legacy, too. He owns that. And for me, that's where the dark part of this Dark Side of the Ring episode really comes into play. Now, I've reviewed every episode of this show through the first 5 seasons. This will not go down as the best episode they've ever done, just because the source material has been analyzed to death and there really wasn't too much new to add. But I thought they did a good job of covering all the key aspects and adding some comments from, you know, not only Foley himself, but his wife, his daughter, 2 of his sons. It was sort of a combo Hell in a Cell Mick Foley episode. because it also covered his career in general, some of the other matches like the I Quit match with The Rock at the Royal Rumble in 99, which is another example of destroying his brain in ways that, I mean, we're not even really aware of yet. It was supposed to be 5 chair shots to the head. It ended up being 11 chair shots to the head. It doesn't matter when The Rock is out there swinging for the fences like he's Barry Bonds. But Chris Jericho is back as the narrator for this season. Jim Ross and Jim Cornette were both interviewed for this, as was Al Snow. He's been friends with Mick for years. They are constantly cracking jokes on each other. There is no joke that Mick Foley could ever tell about Al Snow that is ever going to top the question that one guy sent into Al's You Shoot with Sean Oliver, where he said, I hope I'm remembering this right, but the guy said, you know, Al is quoted as saying that a good match is the one that draws the most money. And so by Al's very own logic, would it be fair to say that Al Snow never had a good match in his entire career? Like, the screenshot of that, as like they're looking at the screen and they have the question on the screen, like it will forever live rent-free in my head. It is one of the greatest things that I have ever seen. Like, I don't even remember what Al's response was to the question. I don't even care. Like, it's just the greatest moment in You Shoot history, followed only by RVD's impersonation of Shawn Michaels. That's number two. Colette Foley, Mick's wife, talked about how he would watch 12 hours of Japanese wrestling a day. That woman must have the patience of a saint. But he felt Japan is where he can make a real living for himself doing all the hardcore shit. And he did. He did death matches in Japan with Terry Funk. Jim Ross is the one who went to bat to bring him into the WWF. Vince McMahon wanted nothing to do with him. And ultimately he relented. He told JR, look, if he doesn't work out, basically it's your ass. And also, I'm going to bring him in, but I'm putting him in a mask. And that's how Mankind was born. Or Mankind the Mutilator, as the original name was, that they wanted to give him before they shortened it. And JR said, you know, he recognized the need for Undertaker to have a new opponent. And Mankind would end up as the Undertaker's greatest rival. I know a lot of people are going to say Kane, and I understand why they would say that, with the story that they created for them. But to me, Mankind is and will forever be the Undertaker's greatest adversary, because he was really the first guy they brought in who felt like an equal to the Undertaker, like someone that had his number. He beat him in their first match at the King of the Ring in 96, and then he beat him again and took his manager from him at SummerSlam. And then came the Buried Alive match and their Revenge of the Taker match after WrestleMania 13. I enjoyed all of those matches. You know, he's also the one who brought that dead man character to the first really great matches that he ever had. He was the Joker to Undertaker's Batman, not Kane. It was Mankind. But Foley said they had 7 pay-per-view matches and 10 television matches together. And then his character had sort of plateaued, and he needed to try something different to add to his legacy. Enter Hell in a Cell, one of the most famous matches of all time. And it wasn't even supposed to happen. This is what they didn't mention in the documentary. Foley was coming off 2 straight pay-per-view title matches with Stone Cold Steve Austin, as Dude Love, and he lost them both. But according to Bruce Pritchard, many years ago on his podcast, the plan was for them to run it back one more time at the King of the Ring. I don't know why, because Austin beat him pretty decisively in their last match, which is a great match, by the way, their Over the Edge match. But that was the plan. Vince McMahon then changed his mind, as he was known to do, and he wanted to shake things up, so he put Austin together with Kane in a First Blood match. And Kane got to win the title for 24 hours. That's one of the things I miss about WWE today. It's like they're afraid to shake things up. We'll have Roman Reigns as champion for 3.5 years, and Cody now is coming up on a year as champion, and they do other things too that just... So often it just feels like the status quo. You know, it shouldn't take The Rock coming back to shake things up. But that left Foley with no opponent. So they put him back together with The Undertaker, even though they had already done 5 pay-per-view matches together. And Foley told Bruce, like, how the hell am I supposed to top what Taker and Shawn did in the first Hell in a Cell? And he said, yeah, he says the same thing that I say, which is that Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker is still the greatest Hell in a Cell match of all time. And there's been more than 50 of them now, including a pretty great one at Bad Blood a few months ago. but the original is still the best one. But Foley was trying to figure out like what he could do to try to top it. So he went to his mentor. He went to Terry Funk. And Terry was just joking when he told Mick, you know what you should do? You should start on top of the cell and get thrown off. Foley didn't take it as a joke. He took it as a challenge. Now, all he had to do was convince Undertaker and Vince McMahon. Somehow, he managed to convince Vince. I don't know how he did, but he convinced Vince to let him do it. Undertaker was not sold on the idea, but eventually he relented. He was probably just thinking, can I even climb up on top of that thing? Because Undertaker came in with a broken ankle. They didn't mention that either in the episode. All the focus was on Foley's injuries, but Undertaker came into that Hell in a Cell match with a fractured ankle. And Jim Ross claims that he had no idea the spot off the top was coming. He liked to be kept in the dark about what was going to happen. The top panels on the cage, they're held together by zip ties. And the zip ties are popping off. Like just in the opening minute of the match from the weight of them walking on them, they almost fell through right then and there. And Mick was going to try a suplex up there. And he said that Undertaker cut that shit off real quick because he was worried that they would both fall through. That I didn't know. I mean, to listen to Mick tell it, you could see where he goes to suplex him and Undertaker stops the attempt. But to hear him tell it, the plan may have been for him to actually suplex him on there. Undertaker's like, yeah, fuck that. That's not happening. And then came the toss. And really, it is the most iconic single moment in company history, I would argue, behind only Hogan slamming Andre at WrestleMania 3. Hogan slamming Andre at WrestleMania 3, that is the moment. Number two is that sight of Foley flying off the top of the cell. I've seen it 1,000 times. It never ceases to amaze me how he didn't kill himself or how he didn't kill somebody else. At least they gave the Spanish announcers a heads up that something was going to happen. Hugo Savinovich has said that about an hour before the show, they were told that Foley was going to fly off. So it's not as if, you know, they kept them in the dark and then Foley just launched himself. But still, they didn't have a lot of time to react. Like, you've got a 300-pound body hurtling down towards you and he's falling fast. It's a miracle that they didn't get killed. Or that Foley didn't land on any of the fans in the front row, or even worse, land on the barricade. Because if that had happened, you know, Meltzer would have had a full obituary for him the following week in the Observer. But he hit just enough of the Spanish announce table to sort of cushion the blow a little bit, and then he hit the floor. And of course, we got the iconic JR call, you know, good God almighty, they killed him. And as God is my witness, he's broken in half. And he's laying there on the floor with a dislocated shoulder, although that was the least of his injuries in this match. He also dislocated his jaw. He was severely concussed. He had three teeth dislodged, one of which ended up sticking out of his fucking nostril. You know, in the episode, JR claims one of the doctors that he talked to after told him that Foley actually swallowed the tooth, but he was breathing so heavily that he sucked it back up through his nose. I'll believe him only because I have no other idea of how a fucking tooth would end up sticking out of someone's nostril like that. So I'm not really in a position on that to be like, oh, I don't believe that, because I don't know how else it would have happened. And at that point, if they would have ended the match, you would totally understand. Yeah, you would have been disappointed because the match just started, but you would understand. But halfway down the aisle, Foley gets up off the gurney. And this son of a bitch starts climbing back up with a dislocated shoulder. Undertaker's already halfway down the cage. Now he starts climbing back up with a broken ankle, no less. And I can remember watching this. I can remember this rush of adrenaline that I got. I'm not even in the match. I'm just watching the match. And I got like a rush of adrenaline watching it, thinking like, if they're going back up there, how the hell are they going to top what we just saw? Right? You know they're not just going to climb down gracefully. Like, why are they going back up? And then came the second bump, which was somehow even worse than the first one. Undertaker choke slams him, and it's really less of a choke slam and more of a shove, down through one of the cell panels all the way down to the canvas. 16 feet down, and those old rings were like concrete when you landed. They had no give to them. It was absolutely terrifying. There was a chair that was up there with them that fell through when Mankind did, and part of the chair smacked him in the face on the landing. Foley was out. He was legitimately out. It was either 45 seconds, whatever it was. He was out. O-U-T, out cold, even though he was moving and twitching around. I thought he was dead. Undertaker legitimately thought he was dead. Terry Funk, in the past, has said that that top part of the cell was rigged to sag a little bit, and Foley would then kind of slowly roll off and then crash down to the mat. But everybody involved claims it was never supposed to just give out the way that it did. That part wasn't planned. And so the first one rushing into the cage to make sure that he was alive is Dr. Francois Petit, who is really less of a doctor and more of a, probably like a chiropractor or a masseuse for Vince McMahon. He also played Sub-Zero in the first Mortal Kombat movie, which is pretty wild. I always played the arcade games as Sub-Zero. He was my guy. I would shoot that ice puddle on the ground and just wait until the opponent got close enough for me to spam them with uppercuts. Good times. But they actually found him, and they interviewed him for this episode. Now, they didn't stop the match after the first bump, which he was lucky to survive. They didn't stop the match after the second bump, which he was even luckier to survive. So they allowed the match to continue. How this man is even able to stand, I'll never know. There's a point there where he gets to his feet, and Undertaker gives him a punch, and he just, like, it wasn't even him selling it. He literally, like, in slow motion, just sort of fell, like, crumbled to the mat. And you could see Undertaker is clearly trying to communicate with him, like, let's go home. Like, let's just take this home. And Foley's like, no. I mean, he's on Dream Street, but he just really wanted to get to the thumbtack spot. This was the first time thumbtacks were introduced into a WWE match. You know, it's funny listening to clips of Cornette on his show every now and then. Whenever somebody does like a hardcore match or a thumbtack spot or a flaming table spot, or Jon Moxley does pretty much anything, and the way he shits all over it, you won't really hear him shit on Foley because of the reverence that he has for that man. But it was people like Mick Foley doing stuff like this that played a part in all the hardcore shit that we see on TV today, including in AEW. Not that deathmatch wrestling didn't exist before Cactus Jack, but like Foley is the one who really popularized it at the highest level and brought it to the fore more than any other single person, at least here in the U.S. He influenced a generation of kids far more than most do, you know, who do this type of stuff. So Foley gets slammed onto the thumbtacks, but he doesn't get all of it. So he tells the referee to tell the Undertaker to choke slam him onto the tacks, which he does. And then comes the tombstone, and mercifully, the match is over. And I can't believe what I just watched. You know, Jim Ross says in 25 years, he's never witnessed anything that even closely resembles this, and I believe him. It's not hyperbole. There's nothing that he ever saw working for Bill Watts in Mid-South or for WCW, let alone WWE, that ever came close to what he saw in this match. And he had a ringside seat for it. And Foley was so out of it that in the back later, he kept asking The Undertaker, like, did we use the tacks? Did we get to use the tacks? And he's asking this while they are pulling thumbtacks out of his body. Like, he had no idea. And so they portrayed it like he also got this great reaction when he was leaving, because he didn't want to be carried out. So he gets to his feet. He was being helped by like Terry Funk and some of the referees, but he wanted to walk out on his own power. And they make it out like he got this great ovation. But if you really go back and watch it, it's not like he got a standing ovation. It's more like polite applause. Right, it was hardly a standing ovation like he would get today. Today, forget about it. They give him a five-minute ovation. You deserve it, and this is awesome, and all this other nonsense. But it wasn't anything like that. And he wasn't even done for the night. They sent him back out during the main event between Steve Austin and Kane, and he took more bumps. His night wasn't over. Dislocated jaw and shoulder, bruised kidney, 15 stitches in his upper lip. a nice big healthy dose of CTE. Was it worth it? 6 months later, he was WWE champion for the first time. He would probably tell you it was. But was it really? You know, I met Foley 2 weeks after this match. They sent him, Owen Hart, Mark Henry, and Luda Vachon into our luxury box at the Meadowlands for Monday Night Raw, the first Raw I ever went to live. And they sent them into the luxury box. They did autographs and they took pictures and just hung out with us for about 15, 20 minutes. And he was in rough shape. And if anybody deserved a long vacation after that match, it was him. But there was no vacation. It was just on to the next. And here in this episode, they jumped ahead to the I Quit match at the Royal Rumble with The Rock. Rock was supposed to bash him in the head with the steel chair 5 times. He got a little carried away, and he ends up taking 11 unprotected chair shots to the head with his hands cuffed behind his back. So it's not even like he could put his hands up even if he wanted to. All while his wife and kids, his little kids, are sitting in the crowd watching in horror. Like, if you saw Beyond the Mat many years ago when it came out, like, it's all documented in there. And as Cornette said here, he got brain damage for a fucking wrestling angle on television. Mick's daughter, Noelle, she says that she has no memories of watching her dad on TV. She figures that she's just sort of blocked it all out due to the trauma. You know, what would she have been back then? 6? 7 years old? She's practically in tears in this, saying how much she hates the I Quit match. Anytime anybody brings it up, like, she hates it. To this day, I have no idea why Mick or his wife thought that it would be a good idea to have his kids in the crowd to watch him get his brains beaten in. 5 times, 11 times, it doesn't matter. I know in Beyond the Mat, he felt really bad about it when he, you know, saw their reaction in the back after. But, like, why would you even allow that? Why would you think that's even something that should be done? And then at the end of the episode, it focused more on Mick's concern about his future health and his family's concern about his health. These are the real-life consequences of all the abuse that he put his body and his brain through over all these years. Like, I'm really happy that Mick is still as lucid and as articulate as he is, because I'm not going to lie, I thought he would be a punch-drunk mess by this point. I'm surprised the man even knows his own name. One of the reasons he does his one-man shows is because he says it helps keep his brain sharp. It's like mental gymnastics for him. Because he is scared to death of how he is going to end up. And he really is a cautionary tale for any aspiring pro wrestler, that there is a price to be paid for not taking care of yourself and taking the kind of bumps that he took. You know, the wrestling business is better off for not allowing people to do the type of things that Mick Foley did. And maybe it's still the Wild West in some companies where they let you do whatever the hell you want and nobody has the spine to tell them no. But Mick took all of this punishment, you know, in WWE back then. In WWE, like today, they would never allow this type of shit. Never. And that's a good thing. So they talked about how Mick started forgetting where he lived when he would be driving. And he said that he didn't like what the WWE neurologist told him. I can only imagine what that conversation was like. So he booked an appointment with his own, and that neurologist told him that you should never wrestle again. He was unequivocal about that. And Noelle brings up CTE and admits that they don't know how her dad is going to be doing in 10 years or in 20 years. And she says that she and her dad, they were at the WWE warehouse not that long ago, and they came across the cell. From that night, she made it sound like it was the actual Hell in a Cell cage that they used in Pittsburgh that night. And Mick, I guess, wasn't expecting it to be there. So he walked over to it and he touched it. And it was the first time she saw her dad cry. And, you know, Foley says he's lucky that he's even here after that match. But he says he doesn't know if he would have done anything different, you know, if they did know then what they know now about concussions. And it's one of those things, and yes, you know, there's been a lot of concussion research, and nobody was talking about CTE or knew what it was back then. That's true. But I've heard, like, guys in the old ECW who took all those bumps and abuse, chair shots to the head, you know, talk about this before, and it's just ridiculous to me. Like, they talk about it in some cases as if, Well, I had no idea that getting bashed in the fucking head with a chair as hard as possible would possibly lead to issues down the road. It's like, even in 1999, I guarantee you, people knew that taking bumps like this and taking shots to the head was probably not a good thing. So, I mean, you're not going to learn too much in the way of new information if you've already had the chance to read Foley's book, or if you've heard him and The Undertaker talk about the match before. But I like the added insight from Foley's family. It's sobering to listen to them talk about their fear of what the future holds, but there's not a whole lot that they can really do about it. You know, it's kind of like whatever will be at this point. He knew the risks. He felt the need to take those risks because in his mind, it was the only way for someone who looked like him to get noticed and to get himself over. And it worked. He was one of the most popular names and important figures of the Attitude Era. Steve Austin needed an opponent coming out of his title win at WrestleMania. Mick Foley was there to put him over twice. He worked with The Rock after he won his first world title. He helped bring out a sinister side of The Rock that we had not seen before. Same goes for Triple H. He helped elevate Triple H to main event status with their street fight at Madison Square Garden and their Hell in a Cell match. He put that man over twice. He breathed new life into the Undertaker character. He gave him his greatest rival. He worked with a young Randy Orton later on to give him one of the most memorable matches of his career. He was very giving in his career, but he gave his body and he gave his health to wrestling more than anything. And nowhere is that more evident than in that Hell in a Cell match with The Undertaker, which, now that they're inducting matches into the Hall of Fame, is without a doubt going to be inducted in the next few years. This Tuesday's episode is all about Ludwig Borga, the man who ended Tatanka's 2-year undefeated streak. I have a feeling that is the least that we're going to be hearing about in this episode. I'm more interested to hear about all the stuff about him that, you know, doesn't get talked about and that a lot of people don't know outside of wrestling. He actually is a very fascinating figure, maybe not the nicest guy, but a very fascinating figure who I think will make a good topic for Dark Side of the Ring. All right, let's get to your mailbag questions. If you've got some, send them on over to solemnmonster@gmail.com. We got a bunch of them this week. Please try to include your name and where you are from. This one here, we're going to kick things off here with an audio question. And this one was submitted by Keish.
Hey, Solo. Keish here. Since it's WrestleMania season, my friends and I were discussing, what 3 WrestleMania matches would you show somebody that has never seen wrestling a day in their life? We came up with this list. Rock versus Hogan at WrestleMania 18, The Undertaker versus Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 25, and Cody Rhodes versus Roman Reigns at WrestleMania 40. What would your 3 matches be?
Okay, so we're sticking to WrestleMania matches only. I would show them Bret Hart against Steve Austin from WrestleMania 13. I would show them TLC 2 from WrestleMania X7. And I would agree with you on Cody Rhodes and Roman Reigns from WrestleMania 40. Because here's the deal. I think you want some variety here, right? Especially for a non-fan. You don't want to just show them a bunch of great technical wrestling matches. Hart Austin is just this great, intense fight between two men. The TLC match gives them that insanity that I think will really hold their attention. I would especially love to see the look on their face when Edge spears Jeff Hardy off the ladder. And last year's main event is one of the greatest that they've ever done. You know, I've said it's like the Avengers Endgame of WWE. Even a non-fan who's not familiar with all the stories, they're going to see John Cena come out, The Rock, The Undertaker, and just all of the insanity at the end, and they're going to be hooked. And once they're hooked, that's when you can show them Savage and Steamboat and, you know, Kurt Angle and Shawn Michaels and Brock Lesnar against John Cena at Extreme Rules and John Cena and CM Punk and Money in the Bank and so on and so forth. Daniel from Chicago. This WrestleMania build has been mid. The Cena turn has not hit like I thought it would. The Rock being gone doesn't help. Cena not mentioning it also has not helped. Kind of makes me wish it was CM Punk who turned heel. He wanted the main event so bad that he was willing to sell out. Then comes the favor. To keep Cody Rhodes strong, you have Paul Heyman help Punk cheat to win. What are your thoughts? I think it could have worked. I think it could have worked. We have to see this through to the end, though. I want to like the Cena heel stuff more than I'm liking it right now. I kind of hate the fact that I don't like it as much as I thought I would, which is why I keep saying, like, I'm just really hoping that they kick it into next gear. Maybe now that the European tour is coming to an end, The Rock will be back and they'll try something different than what we've been seeing. I don't know, but I have no doubt in my mind that if they went with Punk, and especially if they went with your idea, and we ended up getting a Heyman Punk, like a permanent reunion between the two, I think that would have been great. Justin from Chicago. I love how all the Chicago questions are about CM Punk. I echo the sentiment that while the triple threat match is worthy of the night one main event, it feels somewhat lackluster with nothing on the line. So how about this? It's announced that the winner of the match gets a title shot against the top champion of their brand, while the wrestler who gets pinned cannot challenge for their brand's top title for the rest of 2025. Rollins ends up pinning Punk to win the match and goes on to defeat Jey Uso at Money in the Bank to win the World Heavyweight Championship. As a result, Punk begins his downward spiral, knowing that Seth is the champion and he can't do anything about it. This culminates in Punk cashing in his favor with Paul Heyman, which is to facilitate a move to SmackDown. This would build to an eventual match with John Cena for the undisputed WWE Championship as the Night 2 main event for SummerSlam. You could then start a proper program with Punk and Reigns heading into the fall, as both men will be on the same brand. What do you think? Yeah, I mean, it could work. You're going to move Punk over to SmackDown. That's a big name for Raw to lose, you know, without getting somebody in return. So you can't just move Punk over and now you're going to have Punk and Cody and Roman, you know, all on the same show. And then Raw has Rollins. Like, I'm sorry, but that's hardly fair. So that part of it would have to be worked out. I just, the whole idea of like, oh, you can't challenge for the rest of the year. Like, I'm not a huge fan of that. You know, but as far as like him and Cena at SummerSlam and then kind of progressing into a singles program with him and Roman, I think that would be fine. It's just the other stuff that you would have to work out. We got the Mount Vernon kid, Christopher Bennett from the YouTube channel. Are you going to talk about the Mandy Rose debacle that she has been spewing on her Twitter, claiming that she was a double champion and yet she doesn't know the difference between unification and holding two separate titles? Well, you sent the question in, so I guess I will. The whole thing is stupid. You know, Mandy talks about how she makes 10 times more money doing OnlyFans than she ever made wrestling, and yet she's arguing with wrestling fans online over semantics about whether or not she or Stephanie Vaquer was the first ever women's double champion. She wasn't. She unified the NXT UK Women's Championship with the NXT Women's Championship. The moment that she pinned Blair Davenport in that triple threat match with Mako at Worlds Collide, the titles were unified as one. Stephanie pinned Julia and became a double champion at Roadblock. She defended both belts individually on TV this week. That's the difference. Stephanie is a double champion. Mandy Rose was not. This is all very dumb. Jonathan from Charlotte, North Carolina. I was wondering what your take is on some people saying that Adam Copeland coming back from retirement was a mistake. I've heard Jim Cornette say that him coming back has ended up tarnishing his legacy to a large degree. Meanwhile, other people like Tony Schiavone have argued that there's nothing he can do to ruin what he accomplished in WWE. And Sean Ross Sapp also said some of Copeland's booking was ultimately out of his control. Do you think Copeland coming back to wrestling was a mistake in hindsight, or do you think this is all blown out of proportion? I mean, Sean may be talking about Copeland's booking being out of his control when it comes to the Balor match at WrestleMania 39. I guarantee you, though, his booking the last couple of years, that ain't out of his control. I'm sure he has a lot of say into what, especially in AEW, into what he's doing. So to that extent, I don't think that still applies. Do I think Copeland coming back was a mistake? No, and I'll tell you why. Because he gets to go out on his own terms. This is a man who thought his career was over. He was told, you're never going to be cleared. You're never going to wrestle again. So that's it. And at the time he was told that, there was no such thing as AEW. And so in 2011, he thought, well, that's it. I just wrestled my last match. Then he had the opportunity to come back. And I can't fault the guy for coming back and wanting to end his career on his terms, instead of being forced into an early retirement because some doctor said, hey, you can't wrestle anymore. But one thing I can say is I cannot say that his return has really benefited anybody, you know, least of all himself. It certainly hasn't really added to his legacy. You know, I think the best thing that he's been a part of was the program with Seth Rollins. Like, the matches they had were all great, all three of them. And Edge won 2 out of the 3, by the way. So since he came back, even in WWE, he has been booked very strong, and even stronger in AEW. Has he ruined his legacy? No, I can't sit here and say that. You know, he's able to go out there, end on his terms. He's obviously having fun, you know, going out there and working with different people and working with his friends. And when he's done, which I think in the past he said maybe, you know, in the next couple of years, you know, he'll wind down and he'll get to end his career on his own terms, the way that he wants to. He got to work with his best friend again, you know, as enemies. And soon enough, they're going to be working together again as tag team partners, I have no doubt. In fact, I'll say it right now. They're going to be the AEW Tag Team Champions. And I think that he'll look back and say, you know what? That's pretty cool that I had the chance to come back and do all that. But I'm not going to sit here and pretend like it's added so much to his legacy. It really hasn't. But how can I stay here and say that it was a mistake for him to come back when the guy was out for 9 years and, you know, he obviously is still passionate about this and he just wanted to come back and end things on his own terms? I can't say that was a mistake. Jared from Orlando, Florida. If Cody Rhodes wasn't the one who dethroned Roman Reigns, buy, sell, and rent on who you would have chosen to be the one to do it. Drew McIntyre at Clash at the Castle. Sami Zayn at Elimination Chamber, and Jey Uso at SummerSlam 2023. Well, I mean, it's either Drew or Sami. I'm going to sell on Jey Uso. You know, it really should have been Drew at Clash at the Castle, but obviously the story with Sami being the honorary Us and then finally splitting away from them, and then they're in Montreal for the Elimination Chamber. I really don't think you could go wrong with either one, but as far as, like, if we're looking to anoint the next guy, not just have a moment, but, like, really, whoever beats Roman, that's going to be our guy going forward. It's Drew McIntyre. It would not have been Sami Zayn. Sami Zayn, it would have been for the moment, and maybe he would have had a few months, and then that would have been it. Drew should have been that guy. We got Clifford. This is something I've been thinking about for a while. I love Randy Savage, and I thought he was wasted in WCW. Once Hogan left the WWE, it should have been Randy as his replacement. Instead, Vince tried to retire him early and led to his departure. What if this didn't happen? What if Vince allowed Randy to continue his career and we got Savage in the new generation? Attitude, and maybe even the beginning of the Ruthless Aggression era. How do you think the Macho Man would fare? And could he have been just as big, if not bigger, than Hogan? All right, so I'll start with the last question. The answer is no. Hogan was the right guy at the right time. Hogan was this larger-than-life, colorful personality, which is not to say Savage wasn't a very charismatic guy and a colorful personality, but there was just something about Hogan. Vince ran with Hogan, and it was the right guy to run with. And they did tremendous business with it. And Hogan was able to parlay that into a very long, I can't even say illustrious anymore, but a very long career for himself. I can't say that I think Savage would have been as big as Hogan, because I don't think he would have been. But as far as him sticking around, what I would have seen him doing, and his brother talked about how Randy wanted to work a long extended program, maybe over like a 2-year period, and maybe it would have been off and on. But he wanted to work a program with Shawn Michaels that would have paid off, I think, at WrestleMania 10, and he would have put Shawn over. I mean, that's what Lanny claims. We'll never know for sure because, you know, it never happened, right? And we never had the chance to ask Randy about it. But I think that's along the lines of what he would have been doing. I think he would have been working with Brett. He would have been working with Shawn. I think the WrestleMania 9 main event could have and should have been Bret Hart against Randy Savage. And then he could have gone on to work a program with Shawn Michaels. And yeah, he would have worked with these guys. I don't see him lasting into the Ruthless Aggression era. I just think his body was failing him at that point, his knees. And I mean, if you saw Savage, those rare appearances that he made like in the early 2000s, I mean, he was like a totally different person. You know, he was doing more and more steroids the older he got. He was so big and just muscled up, he could barely do anything anymore. Yeah, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I guess he was just very vain and just wanted to look that way, but I don't think that benefited his in-ring style. So I think Savage would have been phased down during the Attitude Era. I don't think he would have lasted into Ruthless Aggression. But no, there was absolutely still value in Randy Savage as kind of the elder statesman top guy in WWE. And he could have worked with all the new generation guys and into the beginning of the Attitude Era. I mean, imagine Randy Savage against Steve Austin, Randy Savage against Mankind, Randy Savage against Triple H, right? The Rock. Rock wanted to work with Savage. He wanted to do a WrestleMania match with him in 2005 before his contract expired. In that little clerical oversight. And that was the end of their relationship for several years. But honestly, I don't think Savage would have done it. I think by that point, Savage was basically a recluse. But imagine that in like 98, right? 98, 99, it would have been great. Vince just didn't see the value in it. Kevin, in Albany, New York. As an on-screen character, has Stephanie McMahon ever been a babyface? I guess you could say the past year she is, but she's not an on-screen character. Yes, she was a babyface when she first started appearing on the show in 1999. She literally had a baby face. But no, she was a face again after that when she was the general manager on SmackDown. So the answer is yes. He says, I know back in the day it wasn't common for characters to change sides. But with that in mind, any wrestlers in recent memory or the past couple of decades that have only been a heel. So I had to think about this. And so you said heel, because I was going to, originally when I read this, I was going to say, you know, Ricochet is a heel now in AEW, but he was a babyface his entire run in WWE. Rey Mysterio in WWE has always been a babyface. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat is the number one example of somebody who stayed babyface his entire career. You know? Someone that has stayed heel from the last few decades, I think that Gunther would qualify. Karrion Kross, right? Even going back to his NXT run, he was a heel. Wade Barrett, right? He's doing commentary on SmackDown every week now, but when he was wrestling, Wade Barrett was always a heel. He never really turned babyface. I don't recall him. I mean, unless you count the Bad News Barrett stuff, which people, I think, found funny and they may have enjoyed it, but he wasn't a baby face. He was still a heel. Jordan from Washington, D.C. With it being John Cena's last year in pro wrestling, I was curious on what you think are his five best WrestleMania matches. I feel like for a guy with as long of a catalog of great matches as he has, not a lot of them have been at the biggest show of the year. What say you? Boy, you could say that again. His best matches most definitely did not happen at WrestleMania. Maybe he can change that this year with Cody. His best WrestleMania matches came against Shawn Michaels and Triple H at 23 and 22. After that, it's his match with Batista at 26, his first match with The Rock at 28, and the triple threat match with Randy Orton and Triple H at 24. I can't include the Firefly Funhouse match with Bray because that wasn't a wrestling match, right? I can't judge that the same way that I would judge any of the other matches that he's had. But those would be my five, you know. His match with Austin Theory was terrible. His match with The Miz was awful. I mean, it would have been perfectly adequate as a television match, but as a WrestleMania main event, it was one of the worst of all time. John Cena has had classic matches at a lot of shows. He's had classic matches at the Royal Rumble. He's had classic matches at Money in the Bank and SummerSlam. Probably at SummerSlam, I would say, more than any other single event. And that includes the night that Brock Lesnar just squashed him. And 2013 against Daniel Bryan and 2016 against AJ Styles. If you want to throw in his 2011 match with CM Punk, it wasn't as good as their Money in the Bank match, but I'll allow it. He just doesn't have a WrestleMania classic the way the most other Hall of Fame guys do. Hogan, Savage, Bret, Shawn, Austin, Rock, Undertaker, Kurt Angle, even Cody Rhodes. Right? They all have at least one great classic match at WrestleMania. You know, Cena's first match with The Rock was a big deal. Had a big fight feel to it. I was there for it. And it did big business. I remember it well, but it's just not an all-time classic. Jason from Jersey. I would like to hear who you think was more justified or laid out a better case for how wrong they were done. The Macho Man had about a year of his partner Hulk Hogan trying to overshadow his spotlight, taking over his WrestleMania 4 celebration, then overstepping the boundaries with his woman, Miss Elizabeth. He didn't just make up complaints. Macho presented a video showing everything he was saying about Hogan being a habitual line stepper. The other option is Bret Hart, with everything that led him giving his turn to blind eye rant on Raw. Michaels cost him the title at the December 96 In Your House. Austin illegally eliminates him from the 97 Royal Rumble. Austin cost him the title the night after the Final Four In Your House. Then the promo in the cage and the fight with Vince. Who would you say had more right to make the change that they did? Macho attacking Hogan or Bret badmouthing the company and the American wrestling fans? I mean, just Savage alone for the fact that Hulk had lust in his eyes for the man's wife. That's it right there. You got to throw hands. If you want to look at the bigger picture, then, I mean, you just listed like four or five different reasons that Bret Hart had to be upset, so... I mean, with Savage, it really was just Hogan was just a look. I guess Linda was right. I guess Linda was right in her Instagram video when she said that Hulk was a liar and that he was a liar. And what did she say? A sex addict. I think Randy Savage proved that many years ago. But who had the greater case for being wronged? I mean, Bret, but again, I think that Hogan putting his hands all over the man's wife, for that reason alone, I don't think too many people would blame Savage for doing what he did. Marcus from Wittenberg, Germany. Since I'm not a native speaker, maybe I'm missing something, but one thing I always wondered, what actually is a nature boy? What does it mean? Multiple people use that moniker, but none of them look like they came out of nature. Shouldn't a nature boy be more like Skinner from the early 90s? Well, you know what? You have a point there, Marcus. I really can't argue with your logic there. Skinner was the alligator man. He definitely came from nature. I just took the whole nature boy thing as like someone who had like natural ability. Because like you said, there were so many people who used it. Buddy Rogers and Buddy Landell and Ric Flair. And I think there were one or two other people. And I think it was just a case of like naturally gifted. I can't say that I've ever actually looked up if there's a formal definition for what is meant by nature, but I don't think there is. But that's just how I looked at it. But actually, I think your logic makes more sense. I think it should be somebody who is from nature. And Molly from Toronto, Canada. You've mentioned some of your favorite movies that have wrestlers in them or star in them, but what are some of your favorite TV shows that have wrestlers in them? It could be a show you never watched before, but you just watched that one episode because a wrestler was in it, like That 70s Show when The Rock was on it. Yeah, I didn't see that one, but for me, it's King Kong Bundy. King Kong Bundy was on Married with Children. That's my favorite. He actually did two episodes, several seasons apart, like two totally different characters. So the first time, it had to be the first or second season of the show, he played a member of Peg's family, Al's wife. and the family members came to visit. I think he was Uncle Otto. He was one of the family members. I remember the end of that episode, he put his head through the door. And then it was many seasons like later in the series, they did a wrestling episode where Bud Bundy had to wrestle King Kong Bundy in a, and he was wearing a bumblebee costume. Bud was, not King Kong Bundy. That'd be fucking hilarious. But Bud was wearing a bumblebee costume. And I think the premise of the episode was that he would have to wrestle King Kong Bundy and beat him wearing the costume if he wanted to get accepted into No Ma'am, which was like the men's group that his father was part of. I think that was the premise. But yeah, so King Kong Bundy would be my favorite. And of course, I mean, how can I not mention Bret Hart on The Simpsons and Vader on Boy Meets World? There you go. So great stuff. Keep it rolling. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is where you can reach me. Of course, you could also reach me and tweet me on X at Solomonster is where I am most active when I am active on social media. Of course, you could also subscribe to the YouTube channel. And if you already are not subscribed, then I don't know what the hell you're waiting for. Make sure you go ahead and change that. We recently passed 85,000 subscribers, so we're already climbing towards 86. I will be live this week on Monday night for the Raw post show, Wednesday night after the final Dynamite before Dynasty, and then Friday night after SmackDown, which they're back on American soil this week. They're going to be in Chicago on Friday night. We have a last man standing match between Jacob Fatu and Braun Strowman on that show. And even though he wasn't announced, I find it hard to believe that you're in Chicago and that they're not going to have CM Punk there. Maybe he won't be on the show. Maybe he'll just be in a dark match, but I would be shocked if he's not on that show in some way. And then back here next Sunday, because it is going to be episode 908 of the Solomonster Sounds Off, and then we got Dynasty that night, a Sunday pay-per-view next weekend. So there's going to be a lot going on. Of course, you can catch me live over on JD's channel on YouTube, Tuesday Night Titans. We've been killing it there, so plenty of content coming up this week. I hope you will join. Thank you for all the support. Thank you for tuning in this week. Leave some feedback. I want to know what you thought of the episode. Be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a great week as we roll on into the month of April. And I will see you for 9:08 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Jon Moxley, in case you couldn't tell, is still the AEW World Heavyweight Champ. That means we have another month of this Death Riders bullshit, and I could barely stomach it. Swerve Strickland is going to Dynasty. He will challenge Jon Moxley for that title, and he better fucking win. He's the right man for the job. Honestly, anybody would be the right man for the job. The Maytag Man would be the right man for the job right now. The Orkin Man would be the right man for the job right now. I could walk out my front door right now. I could go 5 blocks down the street. First fucking guy that I see, maybe he's got a bottle of beer in a brown paper bag, whatever it is, I'll grab him. He would be the man for the job. I would have preferred the Rizzler come out and sign his name to that contract and pin Jon Moxley to win the AEW World title. I would have taken Big Boom AJ as the AEW World Champion.
Who ate my double-tongued chocolate cookie?
Can you imagine that the heads that would explode if that happened? Anybody but what they're doing now, anybody but Moxley, anybody but the Death Rider stuff, we need to move on from this.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solomonster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solomonster.
I love you, Solo.